Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We come. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off and give you a little background on the Fed. And Danielle Del Martino Booth was a Fed insider for years. And this was first aired on November 26, 2018. But it gives us a little bit of background on what we're going to pick up and bring you current with what's happening in the financial markets. And we're going to focus on the Fed and other dynamics that happened this week. Well, here we go with Danielle.
Here we sit at the precipice of what we believe to be the next rate hike at the Fed's December meeting. We're looking to go to 2.25% on the Fed funds rate. Woo! But we know from what Jay Powell has told us that that is still three rate hikes shy of what he considers to be neutral, a neutral Fed funds rate where it's the Goldilocks level, where the economy is not overheating or slowing down. He considers to be 3%. Unfortunately, his predecessor, Janet Yellen, is on record as having implemented the slowest, most prolonged, most painstakingly painful tightening in U.S. history under her leadership. In other words, Janet left Jay with a lot of work to be done, with not so much time. Hello, I am Danielle DiMartino Booth, happy to be back on Real Vision. Since the last time I was on, I have founded a new company called Quill Intelligence. We produce a daily newsletter called The Daily Feather, and it's already garnered a cult following, rolled out right after Memorial Day, and we are looking to truly launch a research revolution that is based on my many years inside the Federal Reserve when I did research on behalf of President Richard Fisher of the Dallas Fed that was unbiased and had absolutely no agenda and wasn't trying to sell anything. And believe it or not, investors really enjoy that. They appreciate that. So how did we get here? Well, it started on August the 11th, 1987. And unlike Jerome Powell, who had no days in office before he was greeted with a crashing stock market, Alan Greenspan had a few months as chairman of the Federal Reserve before he was greeted with the crash of 1987 when stocks fell 23% in one day, which hasn't been matched since then. We might find out in the coming years what it feels like. But in the days and the months that followed, Alan Greenspan did something extraordinary that set up where we are today and where we're headed. He actually leaked information to bond trading desks ahead of Fed moves to inject liquidity into the system. This was fully sanctioned, and he had the New York markets, open markets desk as his compadre to do this. And that was when, in the current era of monetary policymaking, moral hazard was introduced into the system. So following 1987, every other hiccup in the markets, whether it was the tequila crisis in Mexico with the peso, whether it was the Orange County bankruptcy, a few years later we had long-term capital management blow up. Famously, obviously, Jimmy Cain refused to write the check to bail out that big academic-run hedge fund. But every single time there was a liquidity event in the markets, the Fed would come riding to the rescue. So fast forward, I'm going to bring Jay Powell back into this discussion. Fast forward to the fall of 2012. What did we learn on January the 5th, 2018? Well, we had the transcripts released. We actually got to hear Jay Powell in Jay Powell's words, because he's a very quiet man. We got to hear what Jay Powell thought about this era of unprecedented moral hazard and how it had woven its way into investors' psyches. And he basically said, I'm reluctant to vote for this final round of quantitative easing. It has become habit-forming to investors, and by all appearances, we are blowing a fixed income duration bubble across the credit spectrum. I just got goosebumps because look at where we are today. Look at where risk lies today. But the point is, every single time the Fed had to pull out extraordinary measures, it had to pull them out for longer than the prior episode. When the internet bubble crashed in 2000, we had to take interest rates even lower. We had to keep them even lower for a more protracted period of time. And that served to blow the housing bubble up. Obviously, there were many other players, credit rating agencies, investment banks, crooked mortgage brokers, delusional home buyers. But the Fed was right there, keeping money cheap, lower for longer. In the current episode, call it the past decade, we took one step further into the abyss of this grand experiment by keeping money lower for longer and engaging in quantitative easing. There's a name for it. It was designed in 2007. It's called the Bernanke Doctrine. Bernanke took a few people into a quiet room in Jackson Hole, a few of his closest advisors, which is questionable on an ethical level itself, and they laid out the fact that the Fed would have to get to the zero bound first. That was a critical step one before it could then launch into quantitative easing. It was designed in private, and the game plan was laid out for what was to come. So what is quantitative easing, and how does the current era of lower for longer differ from its prior episodes? So we have I still have pronoun challenges as a former Fed insider. How did the Fed conceive quantitative easing? They basically wanted to synthetically produce interest rates that were lower than what they could get them to on a numeric level, the zero bound, as we called it. So in order to do that, they decided to go out into the open market and purchase securities. In fact, inside the Fed, they never called it quantitative easing. They called it large-scale asset purchases because that's what people inside the Fed do. They put big fancy labels on things so that people are confused and don't know what the hell they're doing. So these large-scale purchases were rolled out slowly, one wave after another. It started with the United States. It started with Ben Bernanke, but it was as contagious as the clap. I mean, it went global, it went viral, it went everywhere. And eventually, we had, obviously, the Bank of Japan, we had the Bank of England, we had the European Central Bank, we had the People's Bank of China, one of the biggest quantitative easing programs in existence, was very quietly undertaken in China. So at the end of 2018, at the end of this year, which is very close to us, for the first time in a decade, we will go net negative. We will flip on a global basis to quantitative tightening. To explain how dramatic this is, consider the furor at the Federal Reserve letting Lehman Brothers fail and within the blink of an eye, rescuing AIG, $85 billion bailout. By the end of 2017, global quantitative easing was running at a $2.12 trillion annual run rate. It was as if we were bailing out AIG every single month. And then some. And then started 2018. By October, the European Central Bank had tapered its purchase program, its QE program. It had tapered it down to 15 billion euros per month. On December 31st, that goes away. January the 1st, 2019, the European Central Bank will stop expanding the size of its balance sheet, and globally, we will, for the first time, once again, go net negative on liquidity. And the implications have already been, they've already been gleaned by the markets, right? Deutsche Bank has already observed that 89% of asset classes worldwide are, they're sporting negative returns for 2018. You can't make this stuff up. So the world has already figured out what negative liquidity feels like, what the drought could feel like. U.S. equity investors, maybe not so much. We've had something else going on here in this country this year called share buybacks. So what differentiates the United States from the ROW, from the rest of the world? Why has it been so awesome to be a U.S. stock investor in 2018? Well, I'm afraid I'm going to be a broken record here because it is one word, and boy, does this get, it just gets people so mad because they want to talk about fundamentals and earnings and in a monopoly society, mind you. We have just a few great big companies that are making everything and collecting all the profits. I digress. But what makes the United States the place to be, the it girl for investors? It's liquidity. Liquidity is global. Liquidity is fungible. Liquidity is agnostic. But liquidity also has a home, or had a home, here in the United States in 2018. The tax bill that was rolled out, according to JP Morgan, brought an additional $300 billion in share buyback power into the equity markets. That's on top of last year's $550 billion or so. So estimates suggest that we'll get to the $850 billion mark by the end of this year. Maybe GE's buybacks don't have the same bang that they once did. Maybe Apple's don't either. That might be heresy. But the fact is, we had something the rest of the world didn't. And we benefited greatly from it because the mother's milk of markets was still flowing through the United States in 2018, unlike our international counterparts. So that's what made this one heck of a year. So here we sit at the precipice of what we believe to be the next rate hike at the Fed's December meeting. We're looking to go to 2.25% on the Fed funds rate. Woo! But we know from what Jay Powell has told us that that is still three rate hikes shy of what he considers to be neutral, a neutral Fed funds rate where it's the Goldilocks level, where the economy is not overheating or slowing down. He considers to be 3%. Unfortunately, his predecessor, Janet Yellen, is on record as having implemented the slowest, most prolonged, most painstakingly painful tightening in U.S. history under her leadership. In other words, Janet left Jay with a lot of work to be done, with not so much time as the economy was heading into. As we know, June 2019 will mark the longest expansion in U.S. history. It's really hard to tighten into an expansion that's lasted as long as it has, but that's exactly what Jay Powell inherited. It was interesting that most in the media, when Jay Powell's name was rolled out, said, he's a Yellen clone. This is it. We're in good shape. This guy's going to be our next best friend. He's the market's BFF. And what did Jay Powell say after his first day in office when the Dow was down by four digits? Let me think. He said nothing. And what did he say at the end of February as the risk parity trade unraveled in bloody fashion? I'll borrow from another Real Vision guest, Christopher Cole, Artemis Capital out of Austin, Texas, good friend. And the way he explains it is very simple. The world was basically betting, there was a crowded trade that was betting that volatility would never rear its ugly head approximately forever. So into this comes the beginning of the liquidity withdrawal, which the markets didn't like one bit. Into this steps somebody who's not a Yellen clone, who's going to tighten monetary policy, who's going to be tougher, who's not going to say a peep when markets get upset. So what we saw was the resurrection of the long dead volatility in the month of February. And this is typically how cycles end, by the way. It's just they've never been this protracted. We've never had a year on record like we had in 2017, when the VIX, the volatility index on the Standard & Poor's 500, when the VIX was south of 10 for 50 some odd days in 2017, wiping, I mean, any other year in history, there had been one or two or three days that the VIX was south of 10, and it was always a sign to run for the exits. But not in 2017. Not when you have $2.12 trillion of quantitative easing flowing through the capital markets worldwide, which creates this great reflation trade when only one country's manufacturing sector was contracting. That was South Africa. The rest of the world was booming, floating on this sea of liquidity. Again, once that started to be extracted from the markets come February, once Jay Powell said a whole lot of nothing in reaction to the stock market's hissy fit, then people got really upset. You ended up having an exchange-traded fund shut down that was based on this short volatility trade. The stock market felt that the worst had come to pass. An exchange-traded fund, ironically enough, named XIV, the opposite of VIX, had to shut down. So was this the reserve breaking the buck money fund moment after Lehman fell? Could we all breathe a sigh of relief and walk away and say, boy, thank God February is only 28 months. Can we get back to the market going up again, please? And thank you. Well, companies got back to the business of buying back their shares. And the tax bill was passed. And you have this gigantic surge of fiscal stimulus and liquidity going into this economy. What could possibly go wrong? Well, not a whole heck of a lot. Not until the liquidity once again started to run dry. What happened on October the 1st? What two things happened on October the 1st? Actually, October the 5th. October the 1st, the ECB reduced its taper to $15 billion a month from 30. So one more whisk away of liquidity. On October the 5th, according to Goldman Sachs, 86% of companies in the S&P 500 were in buyout blackout. It was too close to earnings. It was this two-week period around when companies report earnings that they typically are not in the market buying back their shares. So this double whammy of this liquidity being pulled out of the markets, lo and behold, set off an, I won't use that word, storm in the markets. There was a big sell-off. It was not related to being short volatility, however. There's something called the Smart Money Flows Index, and it basically gauges, you can look it up on your Bloomberg, SMFI Go. It basically gauges institutional investors who trade in the first 30 minutes and the last 30 minutes of trading every day. We all know that the last hour of trading in the stock market is the most important. Well, this index peaked in January, and after this unwind of this risk parity, short volatility trade happened, a lot of people came running back into the market, especially corporate America. The smart money stayed out. Smart money was at the lowest level since 1996 in October. It never came back. It never put its trust back into what it was looking at. And lo and behold, it was not the unwind of a trade in October. It was managers selling their biggest holdings. It was managers taking their profits. There are moments in every cycle. I remember in 1999, some sell side strategist analyst came out and said, Priceline's going to 1,000, baby. And these moments stick in your mind. And every day when you're turning on Bubble Vision and they've got a little countdown to $1 trillion for Apple or Amazon, that was kind of my moment. That was my Priceline.com moment in the current cycle. And sure enough, Amazon managed to trim $200 billion of market capitalization off in the space of a few days because it disappointed on its earnings. And what we saw in October was the beginning of the end, of the passive investing trend in this country. I'll share something on a personal investing level. When you spend nearly a decade inside the Federal Reserve, you get a little bit freaked out about how the sausage is made. You get a little bitter about basically monkeying with price discovery, unfettered price discovery. I was raised as a young whippersnapper on a trading floor up here in New York, and I learned about bid, ask, spread, price discovery. That was how the world was supposed to work. Don't fight the Fed is the antithesis of price discovery. Don't fight the Fed has turned into a passive investing revolution, this great renaissance where investors can pat themselves on the shoulder and they can say, wow, I'm paying 0.25%. Look at my low fees. Well, what October taught investors, passive investors, was that momentum that is awesome. I mean, great. Momentum is wonderful when these huge market capitalization stocks are going up, the FANGs. But it works the same way in reverse.
What Danielle was just describing, this goes back, this was aired November 26, 2018, what she was saying. But it's getting, it's a good way to set us up for future ongoing problems with the Fed and with the financial markets. Just recently, she appeared on a Fox News Network program, and this is what she was saying about this recent quarter point. Now, Jay Powell has turned around his thinking and is coming back to declining as a decrease in Fed rates at this point. But listen to what she has to say with other people on this program. Here we go now.
Well, President Trump weighing in on the Fed decision, as you might have expected, to cut rates by just a quarter of a point. He wasn't happy with it. Roll tape.
I don't think he knows how to play the game very well. They've raised too fast, and I've been saying this openly, and they've lowered too slow. So I'm not thrilled with the Fed, but despite that, we have an incredible economy and we don't have inflation.
Chairman Powell's job is safe?
It's safe, yeah, it's safe. I mean, sure, why not?
You paused.
No, I don't pause. I mean, he's got a job, and, you know, I'm disappointed in him. I'm very disappointed in him.
He's got a job. Joining us now, former Dallas Fed advisor Danielle DiMartino Booth and former Kansas City Fed chairman Herman Cain, who also, by the way, ran for president. So, Danielle, first, your reaction to all this. Yesterday he said no guts, no vision about his Fed chairman. What do you think?
Well, look, he's going to continue to berate and bully Powell. I mean, this is great. He's collecting a paycheck. This is what we're supposed to take from Trump. But, you know, in Powell's defense, we've had fresh data out this morning. Jobless claims remain very low. Philadelphia Fed came in stronger than what was expected. So we're still seeing a lot of green shoots in the economy to suggest that the Fed doesn't have to go hit the panic button and ease as dramatically as, say, the Europeans.
But, Herman, you can't ignore the Europeans, can you? I mean, they keep lowering their interest rates, and part of the job of the Fed is to make sure that the United States currency is sort of in parity with what's going on around the world, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But the other point relative to the Fed is that they are inherently cautious. So that's probably why we only saw 25 basis points. But what the president is alluding to is we are not taking advantage of some of the things that the Europeans and other countries are taking advantage of because we are lowering too slow. I believe that that was the president's point.
Well, the New York Fed, this is something that seems to be ominous to some people out there, have been stepping in recently to help money markets, putting billions of dollars in overnight for folks, banks and others who are caught short on cash. Danielle, is this a big problem?
Well, I think it's a big problem if the Fed can't get its arms around what's happening right now. There's a supply-demand imbalance. They came out. They did another operation this morning. These are theoretically emergency measures that they're taking, but you can't take an emergency measure every day. There are some facilities and other options that have been discussed at the Fed that Powell certainly had the option of rolling out yesterday that he chose not to do. So, it wasn't until he mentioned that if pressed, quantitative easing would be back on the table, that it was not until that moment in his press conference that markets began to turn around and come off their lows.
But Herman, we think back to 2007. There were some money market problems that sounded a little similar. They were short on cash. The New York Fed had intervened. Happening again now, is it just a coincidence that it happened in 2007?
I don't think it's a coincidence. And I think that the key question is, did the New York Fed have to do that? Danielle alluded to it. I don't know all of the details, but remember one very important point. The U.S. economy and the world economy are very complex entities. And so one move by one Federal Reserve Board does not necessarily tell you everything that might be going on. And as I said, the key question was, did they have to do it rather than was it the right or wrong
good
thing?
Good question. Good question.
And yes, they did, to answer that question.
All right.
Absolutely did.
The Fed on Tuesday noticed, and what came about was there was a problem in the repo market. The repo market is an overnight market where banks settle debts and credits with each other as far as their reserve goes and so forth. And they borrow and lend each other securities and borrow from that back and forth. Well, there was a spike in that repo interest rate up to 10%, which signified that there was a problem in liquidity in the repo market. So what happened was this caused the Fed Reserve to react with an infusion and injection of well over $150 billion into the repo market. Now we're getting information that they're going to continue this. Today, on Friday, September the 20th, AFP French reporting that the New York Fed handles the levels that control the flow of money in the system. And it has, for the past 4 days, had to pump billions into money markets after bank demand for cash pushed interest rates above the Fed rates. And what we're seeing now is that the New York Fed intend to pump $75 billion into money markets daily through October 10th. So they started out Tuesday with $150 billion, and they decided now to go ahead and start putting into the system, injecting funds into the system, $75 billion. And what that means is that we've got really financial problems. This is the way that the 2007 and 8 financial crisis came about, where you had liquidity problems that began to reoccur, and it knocked down some very, very substantial companies at that time. But this is serious business. They are saying, when you read articles throughout the web, you're seeing people poo-poo it and throw cold water on it and say the financial system is not a problem and liquidity is not. But they have decided to put $75 billion a day into the markets and injecting through quantitative easing. So quantitative easing, here we go again. And I believe just recently the German, the European Central Bank started over again their quantitative easing in Germany. I believe there was a situation over there. So what we have here is we have a house of cards that's been pumped up since 2008 with quantitative easing into the billions and billions of dollars. Now, according to Danielle, in some of her previous interviews, many of the corporations have used this additional liquidity to buy back shares. And that what you have is when corporations issue shares, that are not, or that are just additional shares, but not backed by additional earnings or expansion of assets, then they dilute the other people's shares. What the corporations need to be doing now is that with these infusion of funds and their liquidity, they're buying back. They're doing buybacks of corporate shares. And what that does is strengthen the big investors that are there for long term. It actually increases the value of their shares. But that money does get into the marketplace through the sales, and then that money is reinvested in the market, and that's why we've had such a run-up in the stock market. Now, President Trump has made a mistake in tying his administration to a rising stock market, you know. So I believe that was just, he should have said, well, you know, we're doing things that are good for business and so forth, and we're hopeful that the market will continue to rise. But he shouldn't have directly linked these two things as strong as he did. When he did that, then he'll be associated with a rise, but also with a big decline if that market starts really a major decline and sell-off. So what we have out here today is we have a very, very fragile money system. We have debt that's been increased quadruple since 2008 worldwide. So we have a tremendous amount of world debt. And also in conjunction with that, the Chinese have been lending to different countries and so forth. And there's a lot of debt that's not on the books that we know about. So the Chinese debt that they've created with these different nations and countries, in addition to what is on the books, on the Western financial books, is adding up to a tremendous debt problem. And when you, it's just like right now, Greece has the greatest amount of debt in relationship to its gross domestic product. And when a debt of a country exceeds the gross domestic product, then you run into problems of debt service become very critical. And then you have to look at the people, and you have to go in there and tax. And it gets to be increasingly more and more difficult to begin to meet, okay, these obligations, you know what I mean? And it's horrendous, you know what I mean? It's not easy to talk about these things because, you know, it's a never ending game. Now we have a global weather strike going on worldwide, and we're going to be speaking about that and bringing you some of that in just a moment. And we have ongoing a global climate strike, okay? And it's ongoing from, it started yesterday, September the 20th, and it goes through the 27th. And it's international, worldwide, and many young people are striking on an international basis all over the world. Now, in addition to this, we have some very interesting articles that have come out, okay? And this is going to be very, very insightful as to what's going to happen, you know, to some of these individuals who are out here on strike. There's an article recently on The Intercept, okay? And this article title is "Only a Green New Deal Can Douse the Fires of Eco-Fascism. And we'll discuss that in a little while. The article is written by Naomi Klein, who's a writer researcher out of Canada. And she's talking about the global climate strike, and she's fully, you know, in support of that. And also, she's written a recent book on eco-fascist massacre. One of her, you know, subtitles here is eco-fascist massacre. And the name of the book is On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green Deal, New Deal, Naomi Klein. And I'm going to play next a interview that she had on Democracy Now concerning this new book and some of her views. So we're coming up with that right now. So listen to this closely.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest for the hour is Naomi Klein, the renowned author, the award-winning journalist, the senior correspondent at The Intercept, inaugural Gloria Steinem Chair of Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies at Rutgers University. Her new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. And she is the professor at Rutgers University, where Juan is a professor as well. Juan?
Naomi, I wanted to ask you about a section.
It's a faculty meeting.
Yes, yeah. We meet up at faculty meetings once in a while. You have a section in your introduction that's called The Specter of Ecofascism. And you make the link between what has to be called a movement these days of right-wing extremists involved in mass killings all around the world who actually ape each other and idolize each other. And you begin with the Christchurch killer, but also his references to what happened in Oslo in 2011, the massacres there of Charleston, South Carolina church massacre, the Quebec City mosque attack, and, of course, the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. And talk about this whole relationship between white supremacists and this kind of terrorism and the battle over the climate crisis.
Yeah, so I write about the Christchurch killer in part because that horrific attack, which stole the lives of more than 50 people in New Zealand at two mosques, happened on March 15th. And that day is significant for many reasons. One of them is that was the day of the first global youth climate strike. That is the day that 1.6 million young people around the world walked out of class and took this stand for international solidarity with children all around the world. It really, a movement that is in no way nationalist, right? That is calling for justice at the center of our response to the climate crisis. In Christchurch, the student strike, the rally after the student strike, was disrupted and the students were told to disperse because there was a live shooting just a few blocks away at the mosque. And that was, the killing that I referred to earlier. And one of the things that was, really different about that attack, and he did take inspiration from all of these different mass murderers, was that this killer identified as an eco-fascist. That he said that in his manifesto, wrote that in his manifesto, talked about how immigrants were destroying Europe, destroying, you know, the Christian world and so on. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus in recent years about how do we change the minds of the climate deniers, right? I think the only thing scarier than a far-right racist movement that denies the reality of climate change is a far-right racist movement that doesn't deny the reality of climate change, that actually says this is happening, there are going to be many millions of people on the move, and we are going to use this abhorrent ideology that ranks the relative value of human life, that puts white Christians at the top of the hierarchy, that animalizes and otherizes everyone else, as the justification for allowing those people to die. And so, you know, that is the significance of what happened New Zealand, because I think it was the first time one of these attackers self-identified as eco-fascist. It's not the first time that climate change has been evoked by one of these killers. It was evoked in the Norwegian killer, Anders Breivik, who talked about how climate debt was one of the things he was upset about. He saw it as a conspiracy to redistribute the wealth of Europe and North America to the global south, because they understand that if climate change is real, it does require a redistribution of resources. And this is fundamentally at the heart of where we're at right now. We're at a crossroads where, you know, it's not about who denies it anymore. I mean, I think that within a few years, climate change denial as a force is going to have disappeared. The question is, in the face of this crisis, are we going to
we in the wealthy world hoard what is left, lock out everybody else, see this resurgence in these abhorrent ideologies that never went away. And are we just going to take care of our own, as they say, or are we going to recognize that our fates are interconnected? Are we going to completely reimagine borders, and are we going to share what's left? And this is at the heart, you know, of the tremendous responsibility of our moment.
And I wanted to ask you, following up on that, your response to the way that President Trump and the Republicans are now honing in on socialism and the Green New Deal as a new red scare that they believe will lead them to victory next November.
Well, look, they believe it will lead them to victory because they believe that they're going to be able to define it, right? I mean, Fox News is talking about the Green New Deal way more than any of the other networks, right? And in the liberal newspapers like the New York Times, most of the op-ed columns are attacking it, right? So the reason why Trump believes that this is a great campaign strategy, that the Green New Deal is the new build the wall, is because they are able to lie about it nonstop, right? They right now are setting the terms by saying, you know, it's just all about depriving you of your whatever, your hamburgers, and as we saw in the video, you know, it's just an attack on your way of life and so on. But in fact, there's new polling out from Data for Progress that shows that if you ask unionized workers whether they support the Green New Deal, vast majority of them do support the Green New Deal.
You have Sunrise Movement coming out for the UAW strike, against GM support the workers.
Right. So I don't think this is a winning strategy for Trump. It is only a winning strategy for Trump if the Democrats run away from the Green New Deal, allow them to define it, don't have a story about how this is going to actually create huge numbers of good jobs and a fairer society and better services, whether it's health care or transit. And that's the story we need to tell.
Which takes us to the presidential candidates. Let's go to Bernie Sanders defending the Green New Deal.
The economists have told us that the cost of inaction on climate change will cost some $69 trillion throughout the globe. The scientists have told us that the cost of inaction on climate change will put the entire planet and life as we know it on Earth in serious jeopardy. Because what we have been told is that if we do nothing, the effects of climate change will lead to over 250,000 deaths every single year across the globe from factors including malnutrition, heat stress, malaria, and other diseases. And that is a very conservative number.
And this is Senator Elizabeth Warren being questioned by Univision's Jorge Ramos during last week's debate on ABC.
Senator Warren, should American foreign policy be based around the principle of climate change?
Yes. We need to work on every front on climate change. It is the threat to every living thing on this planet, and we are running out of time. Every time the scientists go back, they say we have less and less time than we thought we had. But that means we've got to use all the tools. One of the tools we need to use are our regulatory tools. I have proposed, following Governor Inslee, that we, by 2028, cut all carbon emissions from new buildings, by 2030, carbon emissions from cars, and by 2035, all carbon emissions from the manufacture of electricity. That alone, those three, will cut our emissions here in the United States by 70%. We can do this. We also need to help around the world to clean, but understand this one more time. Why doesn't it happen? Long as Washington is paying more attention to money than it is to our future, we can't make the changes we need to make. We have to attack the corruption head on so that we can save our planet.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren in last week's debate. And overall, Naomi Klein, if you can talk about the issue of the Democratic presidential candidates attacking the issue of climate climate crisis, the big battle within the DNC, but Tom Perez prevailing at least for the moment, saying there can be no single debate that's just focused on the climate crisis. And then finally, weigh in on the voices that so often haven't been included around the global south and indigenous people in this country who have really led the climate change movement when you look at things, for example, confrontations like the standoff at Standing Rock.
Right, absolutely. So the decision that the DNC made, I think, was a terrible decision not to have a climate debate. And it really shows, I think, a failure to understand that this is not a single issue. I mean, that this is, you know, when the idea was rejected, it was, well, if we can't do climate, it's not fair to the other issues, right? And the whole point of a Green New Deal, which supposedly a majority of the candidates support, is that climate change is not an issue. It is it is an infrastructure for all of these other issues to fit inside, right? We are all inside the climate. Whatever issue it is that we are focused on, it is within the context of a habitable planet that we need to protect, right? What's exciting about a Green New Deal is it doesn't pit these issues against each other, right? It's a holistic vision for the next economy that is about how we radically cut emissions while solving many different crises of inequalities at the same time. So in terms of the different candidates, maybe we can come back and talk about it in a bit more depth. But I think there is a real difference in terms of which candidates have serious plans for how to have a just response to climate change in a global context. We can't talk about climate responses just within the United States or tell ourselves, oh, the U.S. is going to lead by example. It's too late for that. The U.S. owes a climate debt to the rest of the world, particularly the global south. And there has to be a transfer of resources that allows countries that are on the front lines of this crisis to leapfrog over fossil fuels and deal with the impact.
We clearly have to do part two. We'll do it online at democracynow.org. Naomi Klein, her new book, On Fire. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Our children have been indoctrinated over decades and decades for preparing them for global warming and climate change issues on the pro side. So they're out there today on this strike, this climate strike. And so that's how that has come about. Now, getting back to Naomi Klein, she's a very interesting person. I met her in 2011 up at Massey Hall in Toronto. Very nice person, very nice family. She comes from a family that her paternal grandparents were communist, and eventually they gave up communism, according to written, you know, reports and Wikipedia citations in 1956. Now, her mother has gotten, over her lifetime and her career, she got into producing documentaries, okay? And what she came up with was some very, very fine documentaries that I'll give you a list of in just a second. Here we go now with that list. Just getting back to Naomi Klein, her family has been associated, her paternal grandparents, with the socialist communist left. And then her mother did a series of documentaries, you could say. And the name of the series was Organizing for Power, the Alinsky Approach. Her mother, Bonnie Cher Klein, was the director of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different programs here. Building an organization, a continuing responsibility, deciding to organize people in power, and through conflict to negotiation. So there you have her family's being tied directly to Saul Alinsky, much like Obama has been in the past, and also Hillary Clinton. So they're all on the far left. They're on the socialist, even communist left. AOC is right there in the middle of all of them, and they've got this new green plan they're all pushing, and The Intercept is in there also pushing it. So that's what we've got. Now, coming up next is a program put out by Alan Watt on Maurice Strong. And listen to this.
Like Dorothy Lion, Tin Man, and Scarecrow, and The Wizard of Oz, We've all been dancing down the real brick road of settled science, as they call it, the pretense of it, you see, in search of answers from the Emerald City, only to find that we've been, what we suspected all along, the wizard has been telling us fibs. But who exactly is a wizard, and where did this seeming madness all begin? So they go into some of it, and they mention Maurice Strong. He's one big player. Says the whole climate change business, and it is a business, started with Mr. Strong, but it started with the Club of Rome too, who were given the task, this big think tank, given the task of finding a way that they could really rule the people from their own excuses, basically, to do so. So they came up with the idea of climate change and how humanity was destroying the planet. That's what they claimed. So man was the enemy. So you'd need naturally experts to rule you, you see, because you couldn't rule yourselves. It said that would fit the bill, or the words of the those in the Club of Rome. Anyway, it says, Maurice Strong, a self-confessed socialist. Now, you understand what he means by this. This is a multi-millionaire socialist, because he was created and brought up the ladder to be a multi-millionaire socialist by the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Dash Council on Foreign Relations. It says, was the man who put the United Nations into environmental business, being the shadowy figure behind the UN Secretary's General, from U Thant to Kofi Annan. His reign of influence in world affairs lasted from 1962 to 2005. Strong has been variously called the international man of mystery, the new guy in your future, and a very dangerous ideologue. Made his fortune in the oil and energy business, running companies such as Petro-Canada Power Corporation. You surprised how the Desmarais family, that is Power Corporation, they call it. They churn out leaders. And they've churned out God and so many prime ministers for Canada, for instance. And for corporations as well. CEOs. But anyway, it says Canada Power Corporation, Caltex Africa, Hydro Canada, the Colorado Lands and Cattle Company, Ajax Petroleum, Canadian Industrial Oil and Gas, to name just a few. But he was really a front man for the Rockefellers. Complete. They created him, totally, from the beginning. They picked him up as a kid and made him what he is. He's a front man. So his private interests always seemed to be in conflict with his personal persona and his work on the world stage. Strong's extensive range of contracts within the power brokers of the world was exceptional. One admirer christened him the Michelangelo of networking. He described himself as a socialist in ideology and a capitalist in methodology. But see, the idea, those who enrich themselves at the CFR and Royal Institute for International Affairs at the top always fill their pockets. They believe that they're the world's natural rulers.
So we came, we saw, he died.
And when they're picked up, they're told that too, to give them a little bit more incentive to keep climbing the ladder in these private clubs. And socialism is the way of controlling the population through laws with panels of experts, which is Sovietism, the meaning of rule by councils, folks, for those who don't know that. In 1972, he organized the U Thant First Air Summit, the Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment, and it led to the formation of the UN Environment Programme with Maurice Strong, as it said. Later, as the UNEP boss, he organised the first international expert group meetings on climate change. And it led to exotic UN-sponsored organisations such as the Earth Council and Earth Charter. And that was also drafted up by the Rockefellers and Strong fronted for it. The World Resources Institute, the World Wildlife Fund, which is again the head at that time was Prince Philip, and later the Commission for World Governance and the United Nations University for Peace. Remember what the old communist adage was too, this real socialism idea, the test bed for all. And believe me, that the heads of the Soviet system filled their pockets too, by the way, if you think it's a different separate organization. And they said that for them, peace was the end of all opposition. That's how they defined peace. So Strong was the driving force behind the idea for world governance by the United Nations. And look at all organizations now attached to universities for world governance. He dreamt of a world tax on monetary transactions of 0.5%, which would have given the UN an annual income of $1.5 trillion. That's on top of all the other money they get. But equal then to the income of the USA. The stumbling block was the Security Council and their power of veto. So he devised a plan to get rid of Secretary of Security Council, but failed to get it implemented. Then along came the idea that global warming might just be the device, you know, to get his world governance proposal up and running. And it wasn't his, folks. As I say, it's an organization, very old organization. It runs your central banks. It runs your World Bank, your IMF, and the Bank for International Settlements. They didn't believe, these guys never believed that the people were fit for democracy and could be ever trusted in democracy. But they'd use democracy as an excuse to invade other countries that didn't have a semblance of it. Strong was appointed Secretary General of the Air Summit, and in 1992, they pretty well create the organization, then appoint themselves as head. In 1992, addressed Air Summit in Rio, they told the thousands of climate change delegates, it is clear that current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class, involving high meat intake, consumption of large amounts of frozen and convenience foods, use of fossil fuels, appliances, home and workplace air conditioning and suburban housing are not sustainable. And so basically, they said they'd have to end. And this is me ablibbing here too from other articles about them. They said that they would have to basically end a lot of consumerism, be post-consumer, and you're going to austerity. That's the idea behind it. And also, they had big meetings where Strong and others, but he did say that they'd have to eliminate and destroy Western manufacturing. And you think they've got a say in anything? Do you really think that? Because the organizations, all these organizations I've mentioned, they're not, you don't get any say in it. They don't ask for your opinion on anything. They don't care about your opinion on anything. From the United Nations, multifaceted organization, all the way down to anything else, you never ask your opinion on anything. Never mind your vote on it. You don't get that either. You vote these guys in. And it says, there goes the Sunday roast, a house to live in. I haven't seen a Sunday roast since for years and years. The occasional hamburger and generally life on earth as we know it. But what Strong didn't tell the delegates was that he was involved in the purchase of the Colorado Land and Cattle Company, which he bought from Adrian Khashoggi. Remember Khashoggi? Huh? An arms dealer who had strong connections with the Bin Laden family. Interesting how they all come together, the heroes and the zeros, eh? This is a 200,000-acre property called the Baca. Had two hidden secrets. Now, one was it sat above vast underground water systems. It's actually the largest aquifer system in the United States. Just happens to be that. And Strong wanted it to, they wanted to remove the water, being from the American Water Development Corporation to exploit the water by pumping it out for commercial intent, but was stopped by the locals who feared it would destroy the delicate environment, or destroy their cattle systems and everything, and their farming. Here's the power of these crooks, eh? But don't forget too, I think it was Rockefeller who actually owned that Baca Ranch. The Maclean's magazine in Canada, and that's got the original magazine, actually had a big article about Maurice Strong, and he set up a big New Age movement there with all kinds of New Age religion types to try and get together, he said, and create a new culture for the world. But he had gurus from India, he had Buddhists, he had all kinds of New Agers there too.
I had to cut that off. We're running out of time, but you can get that on YouTube. That's Alan Watt talking about Maurice Strong. All these factions, Naomi Klein and Hillary and Obama and all those people coming out of the Fabian Society way back in England, it seemed like to me, in my opinion, they're working towards world communism, and they're using this climate change strike that's ongoing right now to affect their political dominance and manipulation of the public at large. But that's all we have for tonight. And thank you for listening. And there are two movements, the climate change movement and the liberation theology movement, which is purely political. But check into that both. Thank you. Bye-bye.